Eventually, he returned from this awful expedition of dreams. Back in the caravan, he found it hard to talk. He was invited to Zake's for coffee, and he swallowed a tablet of an opiate complex to relax himself in the company of men. In Zake's rover, he sat in his spot and waited for Zake to pass around little cups of clove-dosed coffee. Unsi al-Khal sat on his left, speaking at length about the Islam vision of history and how it had begun in the Jahili or pre-Islam period. Al-Khal had never been friendly, and when Frank tried to pass him the cup that came his way in a standard gesture of politeness, Al-Khal curtly insisted that the honor was Frank's, that Al-Khal would not be prevailed upon to usurp it. Typical insult by over-politeness. The hierarchy again. One could not do favors for one higher in the system. Favors only went downward. Alpha males, pecking orders. Really, they might as well have been back on the savannah or in Washington. It was nothing more than primate dominance tactics again. Frank ground his teeth, and when Al-Khal began pontificating again, he said, "What about your women?" They were taken aback, and Al-Khal shrugged. "In Islam, men and women have different roles, just as in the West. It is biological in origin." Frank shook his head and felt the sensuous buzz of the tabs, the black weight of the past. The pressure on a permanent aquifer of disgust at the bottom of his thinking increased, and something gave, and suddenly he didn't care about anything and was sick of pretending he did. Sick of all pretense everywhere, the glutinous oil that allowed society to run on in its gnashing, horrid way. "Yes," he said, "but it's slavery, isn't it?" The men around him stiffened, shocked by the word. "Isn't it?" he said, helplessly feeling the words bubble up out of his throat. "Your wives and daughters are powerless, and that is slavery. You may keep them well, and they may be slaves with peculiar and intimate powers over their masters, but the master-slave relationship twists everything to it, so that all these relations are twisted, pressured to the bursting point." Zake's nose was wrinkled. "This is not the lived experience of it, I can assure you. You should listen to our poetry." "But would your women assure me?" "Yes," Zake said with perfect confidence. "Maybe. But look, the most successful women among you are modest and deferent at all times. They're scrupulous in honoring the system. Those are the ones that aid their husbands and sons to rise in the system. So to succeed, they must work to enforce the same system that subjugates them. This is poisonous in its effects. And the cycle repeats itself, generation after generation, supported by both masters and slaves." "The use of the word slaves," Al-Khal said slowly and paused, "is offensive because it presumes judgment. Judgment of a culture you do not really know." "True. I only tell you what it looks like from the outside. This can only be of interest to a progressive Muslim. Is this the divine pattern you are struggling to actualize in history? The laws are there to read and to watch in action. And to me, it looks like a form of slavery. And, you know, we fought wars to end slavery. And we excluded South Africa from the Community of Nations for arranging its laws so that the blacks could never live as well as the whites. But you do this all the time. If any men in the world were treated like you treat your women, the UN would ostracize that nation. But because it's a matter of women, the men in power look away. They say it is a cultural matter, a religious matter, not to be interfered with. Or it's not called slavery because it's only an exaggeration of how women are treated elsewhere. Or not even an exaggeration, Zake suggested. A variation. No, it's an exaggeration. Western women choose much of what they do, and they have their lives to live. Not so among you. But no human submits to being property. They hate it and subvert it and have what revenge they can against it. That's how humans are, and in this case, it is your mother, your wife, your sisters, your daughters. Now the men were glaring at him, still more shocked than offended. But Frank stared at his coffee cup and went on regardless. You must free your women. How do you suggest we do this? Zake said, looking at him curiously. Change your laws. Educate them in the same schools your sons go to. Make them the equal in rights to any Muslim of any kind anywhere. Remember, there is much of your laws that is not in the Quran, but was added in the time since Muhammad. Added by holy men, Al-Khal said angrily. Certainly. But we choose the ways we enforce our religious beliefs in the behavior of daily life. This is true of all cultures, and we can choose new ways. You must free your women. I do not like to be given a sermon by anyone but a mullah, Al-Khal said, mouth tight under his mustache. Let those who are innocent of crime preach what is right. Zake smiled cheerily. This is what Selim el-Hayl used to say, he said. And there was a deep, charged silence. Frank blinked. Many of the men were smiling now, looking at Zake with appreciation, and it came to Frank in a flash that they all knew what had happened in Nicosia. Of course! Selim had died that night just hours after the assassination, poisoned by a strange combination of microbes. But they knew anyway. And yet they had accepted him, taken him into their homes, into their private enclosures where they lived their private lives. They had tried to teach him what they believed. Perhaps we should make them as free as Russian women, Zake said with a laugh, extricating Frank from the moment. Crazed by overwork, don't they say? Told they are equal, but actually not. Yusuf Howie, a high-spirited young man, leered and cackled. Bitches, I can tell you. But no more or less than any other woman. Isn't it true that in the home the power always goes to the strong? In my rover, I am the slave, I can tell you that. I kiss Snake's butt daily with my Aziza. The men roared with laughter at him. Zake took their cups and poured another round of coffee. The men patched up the conversation as best they could. They covered for Frank's gross assault, either because it was so far beyond the pale that it only indicated ignorance, or because they wanted to acknowledge and support Zake's sponsorship of him. But only about half of them looked at Frank anymore. He withdrew and listened again, profoundly angry at himself. It was a mistake to speak one's mind at any time, unless it perfectly matched your political purpose, and it never did. Best to strip all statements of real content. This was a basic law of diplomacy. Out on the escarpment, he had forgotten that. Disturbed, he went out in a prospector again. The dreams became less frequent. When he came back in, he didn't take any drugs. He sat silently in the coffee circles, or spoke about minerals and groundwater, or the comfort of the newly modified prospecting rovers. The men regarded him cautiously, and only included him in the conversation again because of Zake's friendliness, which never flagged, except for that one moment when he had most effectively reminded Frank of one of the basic facts of the situation. One night Zake invited him over for a private dinner with him and his wife Nazik. Nazik wore a long white dress cut in the traditional Bedouin style, with a blue waistband and bareheaded, her thick black hair drawn back into a flat comb and then left to fall down her back. Frank had read enough to know that this was all wrong. Among the Bedouin of the Awlad Ali, women wore black dresses and red sashes to indicate their impurity, sexuality, and moral inferiority, and they kept their heads covered and used the veil in an elaborate hierarchical code of modesty, all in deference to male power, so that Nazik's clothes would be deeply shocking to her mother and grandmothers, even if she was, as now, wearing them before an outsider who didn't really matter. But if he knew enough to understand, then it was a sign. And then, at one point, when they were all laughing, Nazik rose at Zake's request to get them dessert, and she said to Zake with a laugh, "Yes, master." Zake scowled and said, "Go, slave," and took a swipe at her, and she snapped her teeth at him. They laughed at Frank's fierce blush and saw that he understood. They were mocking him, and also breaking the Bedouin taboo against showing marital affection of any kind to anyone. Nazik came over and put her fingertip on his shoulder, which shocked him further. "We are only joking with you, you know," she said. "We women heard about your declaration to the men, and we love you for it. You could have as many wives among us as an Ottoman sultan, because there is some truth to what you said. Too much." She nodded seriously and pointed a finger at Zake, who wiped the grin from his face and nodded as well. Nazik went on, "But so much depends on the people within the laws, don't you find? The men in this caravan are good men, smart men, and the women are even smarter, and we have taken over entirely." Zake's eyebrows shot up, and Nazik laughed. "No, really, we have only taken our share. Seriously."
"But where are you, then?" Frank said. "I mean, where are the caravan's women during the day? What do you do?"
"We work," Nazik said simply. "Take a look, you'll see us."
"Doing all the kinds of work?"
"Oh, yes. Perhaps not where you can see us much. There are still some habits, customs. We are reclusive, separate. We have our own world. It is perhaps not good. We Bedou tend to group together, men and women. We have our traditions, you see, and they endure. But there is much that is changing here, changing fast, so that this is the next stage of the Islamic way. We are..." She searched for the word.
"Utopia," Zake suggested.
"The Muslim utopia." She waggled a hand doubtfully.
"History," she said.
"The Hajj to utopia."
Zake laughed with pleasure.
"But the Hajj is the destination," he said. "That is what the mullahs always teach us, so we are already there, no?"
And he and his wife smiled at each other. A private communication with a high density of information exchange, a smile which they shared for a moment with Frank. And their talk veered elsewhere. In practical terms, Al-Kahira was the pan-Arab dream come alive, as all the Arab nations had contributed money and people to the Majaris. The mix of Arab nationalities on Mars was complete, but in the individual caravans it separated out a bit. Still, they mixed, and whether they came from the oil-rich nations or the oil-poor ones didn't seem to matter. Here, among the foreigners, they were all cousins. Syrians and Iraqis, Egyptians and Saudis, Gulf Staters and Palestinians, Libyans and Bedouins, all cousins here. Frank began to feel better. He slept deeply again, refreshed by the time slip in every day, a little slack in the circadian rhythm, the body's own time off. Indeed, all life in the caravan had an altered duration, as if the moment itself had dilated. He felt there was time to spare, that there was never a reason to hurry. And the seasons rolled by. The sun set in almost the same spot every night, shifting ever so slowly. They lived entirely by the Martian calendar now. It was the only new year they noticed or celebrated. LS equals zero, the start of northern spring of the year 16. Season after season, each 6 months long, and each passing in the absence of the old sharp sense of mortality. It was like living in the eternal now, in an endless round of works and days, in the continuous cycle of prayer to the oh-so-distant Mecca, in the ceaseless wandering over the land, in the always cold. One morning they woke to find it had snowed in the night, and the whole landscape was pure white and mostly water ice. The whole caravan went crazy for the day, all of them, men and women, outside in walkers, giddy at the sight, kicking snow, making snowballs that didn't cohere satisfactorily. trying to pile snowmen that likewise didn't stick together. The snow was too cold. Zeke laughed hard at these efforts. "What an albedo," he said. "It's astonishing how much of what Sax does rebounds against him. Feedbacks naturally adjust toward homeostasis, don't you think? I wonder if Sax shouldn't have first made things so much colder that the whole atmosphere froze out onto the surface. How thick would it be? A centimeter? Then line up our harvesters pole to pole and run them around the world like latitude lines, processing the carbon dioxide into good air and fertilizer. Huh! Can't you see it?" Frank shook his head. "Sax probably considered it and rejected it for some reason we don't see." "No doubt." The snow sublimed away, the red land returned, they traveled on their way. Occasionally they passed nuclear reactors standing like castles on the top of the escarpment, not just Rickovers, but giant Westinghouse breeders with frost plumes like thunderheads. On Mangalavid, they saw programs about a fusion prototype in Chasma Borealis, canyon after canyon. They knew the land in a way that even Anne didn't. Every part of Mars interested her equally, so she couldn't have this focused knowledge of a single region, this way they had of reading it like a story, following its leads through the red rock to a patch of blackish sulfides or the delicate cinnabar of mercury deposits. They were not so much students of the land as lovers of it. They wanted something from it. Anne, on the other hand, asked for nothing but answers. There were so many different kinds of desire. Days passed, and then more seasons. When they ran into other Arab caravans, they celebrated long into the night with music and dance, coffee and hookahs and talk, in meeting tents covering an octagon of parked rovers. Their music was never recorded, but played with great facility on flutes and electric guitars, and mostly sung in quarter tones and wails so strange to Frank's ear that for a long time he couldn't tell if the singers were accomplished or not. The meals lasted hours, and afterward they talked till dawn and made a point of going out to watch the furnace blast of sunrise. When they met with other nationalities, however, they were naturally more reserved. Once they passed a new Amex mining station manned mostly by Americans, perched on one of the rare big veins of mafic rock rich in platinoids in Tantalus Fossae near Alba Patera. The mine itself was down on the long flat floor of the narrow rift canyon, but it was mostly robotic, and the crew lived up in a plush tent on the rim overlooking the rift. The Arabs circled next to this tent, made a brief guarded visit inside, and retreated into their insectile rovers for the night. It would have been impossible for the Americans to learn a thing about them. But that evening Frank went back over into the Amex tent by himself. The folks inside were from Florida, and their voices brought up memories in him like nets filled with coelacanths. Frank ignored all the little mental explosions and asked question after question, concentrating on the black and Latino and redneck faces that answered him. He saw that this group was imitating an earlier form of community, just like the Arabs did. This was a wildcat oil field crew, enduring harsh conditions and long hours for big paychecks, all saved for the return to civilization. It was worth it, even if Mars sucked, which it did. I mean, even on the ice you can go outside, but here, fuck! They didn't care who Frank was, and as he sat among them listening, they told stories to each other that astonished him, even though they were somehow deeply familiar. "There was 22 of us prospecting with this little mobile habitat with no rooms to it, and one night we got to partying and took all our clothes off. And all the women got in a circle on the floor with their heads in the middle, and the guys went in a circle around the outside. And there were 12 guys and 10 gals, so the two guys out kept the rotation going pretty fast, and we actually got all the way around the circle in the time slip. We tried to all come at once at the end of the time slip, and it worked pretty good. Once a few couples got going, it was like a whirlpool, and it sucked everyone down into it. Felt so good. And then, after the laughter and the shouts of disbelief,
"We was killing and freezing these hogs in Acidalia, and those humane killers are like shooting a giant arrow into their heads, so we figured why not kill and freeze them both at once and see what happens. So we got them all handicapped and bet on which ones would get the furthest. And we opened the outer locked door, and those pigs all dash out outside, and wham! They all keeled over inside of 50 yards of the door, except for one little gal that got almost 200 yards and froze standing upright. I win $1,000 on that hog."
Frank grinned at their howls. He was back in America. He asked them what else they had done on Mars. Some had been building nuclear reactors up on top of Pavonis Mons, where the space elevator would touch down. Others had worked on the water pipe running up eastern Tharsis Bulge from Noctis to Pavonis. The parent transnational for the elevator, Praxis, had a lot of interests at the bottom end, as they called it.
"I worked on a Westinghouse on top of the Compton Aquifer under Noctis, which is supposed to have as much water in it as the Mediterranean, and this reactor's entire job was going to be to power a bunch of humidifiers. Fucking 200 megawatts of humidifier. They're the same as the humidifier I had in my bedroom when I was a kid, except they take 50 kilowatts apiece. Gigantic Rockwell monsters with single-molecule vaporizers and jet turbine engines that shoot the mist out of 1,000-meter stacks. Fucking unbelievable. 1 million liters a day of H&O added to the air."
Another of them had been building a new tent city in the Eckes Channel, below Overlook.
"They've tapped an aquifer there, and there's fountains all over town. Statues in the fountains, waterfalls, canals, ponds, swimming pools, you name it. It's a little Venice up there. Great thermal retention, too."
The conversation removed itself to the gym, which was well stocked with machines designed to enable their users to stay Earth-ready.
"He's buffed. Look at that. Must be short time."
Almost everyone kept to a rigorous workout schedule, 3 hours a day minimum.
"If you give up, you're stuck here, right? And then what good is that savings account?"
"Eventually it'll be legal tender,"
another one of them said.
"Where people go, the American dollar is sure to follow."
"You got it backwards, assbite.
As we are the proof of,"
Frank said. "I thought the treaty blocked the use of Terran money here."
"The treaty's a fucking joke,"
said one doing lat pulls.
"That is Bessie the long-distance hog."
They stared at Frank, all of them in their 20s and 30s, a generation he had never talked to much. He didn't know how they had grown up, what had shaped them, what they might believe. The oh-so-familiar accents and faces might be deceptive. In fact, probably were.
"You think so?"
he asked. Some of them seemed more aware than the rest that he might be connected to the treaty, along with all his other historical associations. But the man doing lat pulls was oblivious.
"We're here on a deal that the treaty says is illegal, man. And it's happening all over. Brazil, Georgia, the Gulf States, all the countries that voted against the treaty are letting the transnats in. It's a contest among the flags of convenience as to how convenient they can be. And Unoma is flat on its back with its legs spread, saying, 'More, more!' Folks are landing by the thousands, and most are employed by transnats. They've got their government visas and 5-year contracts, including rehab time to get your earth buffed, things like that."
"By the thousands?" Frank said.
"Oh, yeah, by the tens of thousands."
He hadn't looked at TV, he realized, for a long time. A man doing military presses spoke between lifts of the whole stack of black weights.
"It's gonna blow pretty soon. A lot of people don't like it. Not just old-timers like you. A whole bunch of new-timers, too. They're disappearing in droves. Whole operations. Whole towns sometimes. Came on a mine in Sirtis. Completely empty. Everything useful gone. Completely stripped. Even stuff like locked doors, oxygen tanks, toilets. Stuff that'd take hours to pull loose."
"Why did they do that?"
"Going native,"
a bench presser exclaimed.
One over by your comrade Arkady Bogdanov.
From flat on his back, this man met Frank's gaze. A tall, broad-shouldered black man with an aquiline nose. He said,
"They get up here, and the company tries to look good. Gyms and good food and rec time and all. But what it comes down to is them telling you everything you can do and can't do. It's all scheduled. When you wake up, when you eat, when you shit. It's like the Navy has taken over Club Med, you know? And then here comes your bro Arkady saying to us, 'You're Americans, boys. You gotta be free. This Mars is New Frontier, and you should know some of us are treating it that way. We ain't no robot software. We're free men, making our own rules on our own world, and that's it, man.'"
The room crackled with laughter. Everyone had stopped to listen.
"That does the trick. Folks get up here and they see their scheduled software. They see they can't keep Earth buffed without they spend their whole time in here sucking the air hose, and even then I expect it's impossible. They lied to us, I'll bet. So the pay means nothing, really. We're all software and maybe stuck here for good. Slaves, man, fucking slaves. And believe you me, that's pissing a lot of folk off. They're ready to strike back, I mean to tell you. And that's the folks who are disappearing. Gonna be a whole lot of them before it's all over."
Frank stared down at the man.
"Why haven't you disappeared?"
The man laughed shortly and began pumping weights again.
"Security!"
someone else called from the Nautilus machine. Military press disagreed.
"Security's lame, but you gotta have somewhere to go. Soon as Arkady shows, gone."
"One time," bench press said. "I saw a vid of him where he talked about how folk of color are better suited for Mars than white folk. How we do better with the UV.
"Yeah, yeah."
They were all laughing at that, both skeptical and amused at once.
"It's bullshit, but what the hell," bench press said. "Why not? Why not? Call it our world. Call it Nova Africa. Say no boss is gonna take it away from us this time."
He was laughing again, as if everything he had said was no more than a funny idea, or else a hilarious truth, a truth so delicious that just saying it made you laugh out loud. And so very late that night, Frank went back to the Arab rovers, and he continued on with them, but it wasn't the same. He had been yanked back into time, and now the long days and the prospector only made him itch. He watched TV. He made some calls. He had never resigned as secretary. The office had been run in his absence by Assistant Secretary Slezinski and the staff, and he had done just enough by phone for them to cover for him, telling Washington that he was working, then that he was doing deep research, then that he was taking a working vacation, and that as one of the first 100 he needed to be out there wandering around. It wouldn't have lasted much longer, but when Frank called Washington directly, the president was pleased, and in Burroughs the exhausted-looking Slezinski looked happy indeed. In fact, the whole Burroughs office sounded pleased that he planned to come back, which surprised Frank quite a bit. When he had left Burroughs, disgusted at the treaty and depressed about Maya, he had been, he thought, a bastard of a boss. But here they had covered for him for almost 2 years and seemed happy to hear he was coming back. People were strange. The aura of the first 100, no doubt. As if that mattered. So Frank returned from his final prospecting trip and sat that evening in Zake's rover, sipping his coffee, watching them talk. Zake and Al-Khan and Yusef and the rest, and, wandering in and out of the room, Nazik and Aziza. People who had accepted him. People who in some sense understood him. By their code, he had done the necessary things. He relaxed in the flow of Arabic, still and always awash with ambiguity. Lily, river, forest, lark, jasmine. Words that might refer to a Waldo hand, a pipe, a kind of talus, robot parts. Or perhaps just to Lily, river, forest, lark, jasmine. A beautiful, beautiful language. The speech of the people who had taken him in and let him rest. But he would have to leave. They had arranged things so that if you spent half the year in Underhill, you were assigned a permanent room of your own. Towns all over the planet were adopting similar systems, because people were moving around so much that no one felt at home anywhere, and this arrangement seemed to mitigate that. Certainly the first 100, who were among the most mobile Martians of all, had started spending more time in Underhill than they had in the years before, and this was mostly a pleasure to most of them. At any given time, 20 or 30 would be around, and others came in and stayed for a while between jobs, and in the constant come-and-go, they had a chance to carry on a more or less continuous conference on the state of things, with newcomers reporting what they had seen firsthand, and the rest arguing about what it meant. Frank, however, didn't spend the required 12 months a year in Underhill, and so he didn't have a room there. He had moved the department's head offices to Burroughs back in 2050, and before joining the Arabs in 57, the only room he had kept was there in the offices. Now it was 59, and he was back, in a room one floor down from his old one. Dropping his bag on the floor and looking around at the room, he cursed aloud. To have to be in Burroughs in person, as if one's physical presence made any difference these days. It was an absurd anachronism, but that's the way people were. Another vestige of the savannah. They lived like monkeys still, while their new god powers lay around them in the weeds. Sluzinski came in. Though his accent was pure New York, Frank had always called him Jeeves, because he looked like the actor in the BBC series. "We're like dwarves in a Waldo," Frank said to him angrily. "One of those really big Waldo excavators. We're inside it and supposed to be moving a mountain, and instead of using the Waldo capabilities, we're leaning out of a window and digging with teaspoons, and complimenting each other on the way we're taking advantage of the height." "I see," Jeeves said carefully. But there was nothing to be done about it. He was back in Burroughs, hurrying around, 4 meetings an hour, conferences that told him what he already knew, which was that Unoma was now using the treaty for toilet paper. They were approving accounting systems which guaranteed that mining would never show any profits to distribute to the General Assembly members, even after the elevator was working. They were handing out necessary personnel status to thousands of emigrants. They were ignoring the various local groups, ignoring Mars First. Most of this was done in the name of the elevator itself, which provided an endless string of excuses. 35,000 kilometers of excuses, $120 billion of excuses, which was not all that expensive, actually, compared to the military budgets of the past century. And most of the elevator funds had been needed in the first years of finding the asteroid and getting it into proper orbit, and setting up the cable factory. After that, the factory ate the asteroid and spit out the cable, and that was that. They only had to wait for it to grow long enough and nudge it down into position. A bargain. A real bargain. And also a great excuse for breaking the treaty whenever it seemed expedient. "God damn it!" Frank shouted at the end of a long day in the first week back. "Why has Unoma caved like this?" Jeeves and the rest of his staff took this as a rhetorical question and offered no theories. He had definitely been away too long. They were afraid of him now. He had to answer the question himself. "It's greed, I guess. They're all getting paid off in one cosmeticized way or another." At dinner that night, in a little café, he ran into Janet Blylevin and Ursula Cole and Vlad Tanyev. As they ate, they watched the news from Earth on a bar TV. Really, it had gotten to be almost too much to watch. Canada and Norway were joining the plan to enforce population growth slowdown. No one would say population control, of course. It was a forbidden phrase in politics, but that's what it was, in fact. and it was turning into the tragedy of the commons all over again. If one country ignored the UN resolutions, the nearby countries were howling for fear of being overwhelmed. Another monkey fear, but there it was. Meanwhile, Australia, New Zealand, Scandinavia, Azania, the United States, Canada, and Switzerland had all proclaimed immigration illegal, while India was growing by 8% a year. Famine would solve that, as it would in a lot of countries. The Four Horsemen were good at population control. Until then, the TV cut to an ad for a popular diet fat which was indigestible and went right through the gut unchanged. Eat all you want. Janet clicked off the TV. Let's change the subject. They sat around their table and stared at their plates. It turned out Vlad and Ursula had come from Acheron because there was an outbreak of resistant tuberculosis in Elysium. The cordon sanitaire has fallen apart, Ursula said. Some of the emigrant viruses will surely mutate or combine with one of our tailored systems. Earth again. It was impossible to avoid it. Things are falling apart down there, Janet said. It's been coming for years, Frank said harshly, his tongue loosened by the faces of his old friends. Even before the treatment, life expectancy in the rich countries was nearly double that in the poor. Think about that. But in the old days, the poor were so poor they hardly knew what life expectancy was. The day itself was their whole concern. Now every corner shop has a TV and they can see what's happening. That they've got AIDS while the rich have the treatment. It's gone way beyond a difference in degree. I mean, they die young and the rich live forever. So why should they hold back? They've got nothing to lose. And everything to gain, Vlad said. They could live like us. They huddled over cups of coffee. The room was dim. The pine furniture had a dark patina, stains, nicks, fines rubbed in by hand. It could have been one of those nights in that distant time when they were the only ones in the world, a few of them up later than the rest, talking. Except Frank blinked and looked around and saw in his friends' faces the weariness, the white hair, the turtle faces of the old. Time had passed. They were scattered over the planet, running like he was, or hidden like Hiroko, or dead like John. John's absence suddenly seemed huge and gaping, a crater on whose rim they huddled glumly, trying to warm their hands. Frank shuddered. Later, Vlad and Ursula went to bed. Frank looked at Janet, feeling immobilized, as he sometimes did at the end of a long day, incapable of ever moving again. "Where's Maya these days?" he asked, to keep Janet from retiring, too. She and Maya had been good friends in the Hellas years. "Oh, she's here in Barros," Janet said. "Didn't you know?" "No. She's got Samantha's old rooms. She may be avoiding you." "What?" "She's pretty mad at you."
"Mad at me?"
"Sure." She regarded him across the dim, faintly humming room. "You must have known that." While he was still considering how open to be with her, he said, "No, why should she be?" "Oh, Frank," she said. She leaned forward in her chair. "Quit acting like you've got a stick up your ass. We know you. We were there. We saw it all happen." And as he was recoiling, she leaned back and said calmly, "You must know that Maya loves you. She always has." "Me?" he said weakly. "It's John she loved." "Yeah, sure, but John was easy. He loved her back, and it was glamorous. It was too easy for Maya. She likes things hard, and that's you." He shook his head.
"I don't think so."
Janet laughed at him. "I know I'm right. She's told me as much. Ever since the treaty conference, she's been angry at you, and she always talks when she's mad."
"But why is she angry?"
"Because you rejected her. Rejected her after pursuing her for years and years, and she got used to that. She loved it. It was romantic, the way you persisted. She took it for granted, sure, but she loved you for it, and she liked how powerful you were, and now John is dead, and she could finally say yes to you, and you sent her packing. She was furious, and she stays mad a long time. This, Frank struggled to collect himself, it just doesn't match with my understanding of what's happened. Janet stood up to go, and as she walked by him, she patted him on the head. Maybe you ought to talk to Maya about it then. She left. For a long time, he sat there, feeling stunned, examining the shiny grain of his chair arm. It was hard to think. Eventually, he stopped trying and went to bed.